Good afternoon. It's just about 12 o'clock, and that means that it's time for KMXT's Noon News. I'm your host this afternoon, Dylan Samard.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. markets end the day with the Dow plummeting more than 970 points. That and other major market indices sliding more than 2.5%. NPR's Raphael Nam on what's behind the market upset.
It was a tough day in Wall Street, and it comes down to fears about inflation. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is now indicating the Fed needs to be much more aggressive about fighting inflation. That's going to mean higher interest rates this year, and investors fear those higher rates could tip the economy into a recession.
NPR's Raphael Nam reporting. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was under cross-examination in a Georgia courtroom today, defending herself against allegations that she encouraged supporters online to attack the U.S. Capitol last year and therefore should not be allowed to run in next month's primary.
I never mean anything for violence. I don't support violence of any kind, and I've said it over and over again.
Greene repeatedly denied or said she did not recall videos, tweets, or retweets about supporting an uprising at the Capitol. A lawyer cross-examining Greene asked her if the words to Trump supporters to not go quietly into the night were hers or borrowed. She and others laughed when he offered to play a famous clip from the Humans vs. Aliens movie Independence Day. The actor playing a U.S. president is heard saying, "Humanity will not go quietly into the night." By the time the clip ended, the laughs had died down. Russia's military is openly spelling out the goals of what it calls the second phase of its special military operation in Moscow. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
According to a senior military official, Russia's new objective is to seize full control over the Donbas and southern Ukraine in order to secure a land corridor to Crimea. That's the peninsula Russia annexed from Ukraine back in 2014 when the Kremlin sent its forces into Ukraine in what Moscow said was a defense of Russian-speaking Crimeans from Ukrainian nationalists. Yet the military official, the acting commander of Russia's central military district, Rustam Minikeyev, also said control over Ukraine's south would provide Russian forces with other options that included passage into Transnistria, another breakaway territory in neighboring Moldova, where Minikeyev claimed Russian-speaking populations also faced oppression. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Pennsylvania is the first major fossil fuel-producing state to start pricing carbon emissions. Here's WITF's Rachel McDevitt.
The new regulation sets the state up to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, an effort of 11 other states to cut emissions from power plants. Pennsylvania is the fourth highest carbon emitter in the country. It produces more natural gas than any state except Texas and is a top energy exporter. The rule takes effect more than 2 years after Governor Tom Wolf started the process with an executive order. The Republican-controlled state legislature has tried and failed to stop the rule. Lawmakers say they will now take the fight to court, which could delay the state's participation. For NPR News, I'm Rachel McDevitt in Harrisburg.
It's NPR News.
Seaweed farmers are sprouting up in the south central and southeastern waters around Alaska, and kelp farmers are almost running out of places to sell it. As KMXT reports, a new seaweed processing workshop is trying to get growers involved in kelp processing, and perhaps even creating and selling their own kelp products. Some 20 aspiring kelp entrepreneurs got hands-on experience on Thursday processing ribbon and sugar kelp in a few different ways. Some are involved in pilot growing programs scattered around the Alaska coast. Some are involved in recently opened farms. All of them are convinced that they are slicing, grinding, brining, and freeze-drying the crop of the future. Chris Sinito is an Alaska Sea Grant seafood technology specialist and is one of the instructors for the workshop.
I think it's very early in the game here. I think other parts of Alaska are still in their infancy as far as processing and growing kelp. We've had a few seasons under our belt, so I think the growing side of it, they've got it down.
Sinito's three-day workshop began Wednesday at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center and features a mix of classroom work and hands-on processing. While Alaska seaweed farmers may have some meaningful experience under their belt, that doesn't mean that it's arrived at the cash crop status that some may have expected. The seaweed market is still relatively small, and with only a handful of brands selling a small catalog of Alaska seaweed products, there's still some more market development to be done. That's what Sinito hopes this workshop will do.
part of the workshop is going to be given the participants their own tools and kind of latitude to create value-added products. You know, we've already experimented with some commercial products like kelp tortillas with the help of Taco Loco in Anchorage. And by making a dried kelp material, participants can experiment with their own value-added product forms. And around the state, for years, entrepreneurs have been using kelp to get products in the marketplace, and some have been fairly successful.
That entrepreneurial spirit has certainly motivated some of the attendees, such as Sean Denadel, a kelp farmer from Cordova.
There's definitely other companies already doing those products, and I think there's still opportunity to make more, so, or make similar products. So yeah, just experiment and see what we can do with it. And I'm excited to see what everybody else here is going to create.
Zanito says the workshop was the first of its kind in Kodiak. There have been others held for aspiring growers during recent years, but this is the first to focus on kelp processing. Alaskans were given priority as attendees, and the class was capped at 20 participants. As for where the kelp market will go, it's not yet clear. But a recently discovered feature of kelp has Chris Zanito anticipating a boom in demand.
One of the exciting projects going on is introducing kelp into agriculture feed. And we've got a project where some of this kelp harvested this year will be introduced as a food component in pork farmers, which will apparently change the microflora in the animal's digestive tract and lead to less gas production and better absorption of nutrients from the animals.
While Alaska's seaweed production is still a very small part of the global market, aquatic farm harvest has ballooned from 18,000 pounds in 2017 to over 440,000 pounds in 2020. And active farm sites in Alaska are set to double to 8 in 2022. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard. Fairbanks North Pole area wintertime fine particulate pollution has come down significantly over the past decade, but remains well above a federal standard. That's one of the takeaways from a recently released annual air quality report from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The air quality report is for what's known as the Fairbanks North Pole non-attainment area, where wintertime fine particulate levels have been out of compliance since the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency began tightening standards more than a decade ago because of serious health problems linked to breathing the tiny particles known as PM2.5. The burning of wood for home heating has been the primary target of local pollution reduction measures, and tens of millions of dollars have been invested in helping people switch to cleaner burning stoves or less polluting heat sources like oil or natural gas. Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Program Manager Cindy Heil says comparing PM2.5 data from a monitor on Hurst Road in North Pole in 2012 with numbers from this past year shows a more than 50% reduction in fine particulate levels.
The Hurst Road calculated value for the 2012 reading was 158 micrograms per cubic meter. And the calculated value for 2021 preliminarily at the Hurst Road in North Pole is 69.9 micrograms per cubic meter.
Heil attributes the long-term pollution reduction to numerous efforts, including the Fairbanks North Star Borough Run wood stove changeout program, but also to an attitude shift.
People are more willing to acknowledge that there's air quality issues.
But she says additional improvements in air quality are becoming harder to attain, with monitoring showing no real reductions over the last 2 years.
We're kind of like bouncing around right now.
Heil says levels could trend down again with additional air quality education and enforcement efforts, new federal funding for the changeout program, and a fall 2022 mandated switch to cleaner burning number one heating oil. But the area faces a steep challenge to meet the EPA's PM2.5 standard by a 2024 year-end deadline.
We'd have to drop another 50%.
Heil says if the Fairbanks North Pole non-attainment area falls short, it will trigger development of a new plan to achieve the standard.
And it'll require more stringent control measures.
Heil notes that the EPA reviews air quality standards for each type of pollutant every 5 years based on the latest health research, and the PM2.5 standard could be adjusted down again.
And now they're even talking about micro even the subparticles of PM2.5, the small, even ultrafine, they're calling it ultrafine particulates.
Heil says a more stringent PM standard would likely result in additional Alaska communities being out of compliance and having to develop their own pollution reduction plans. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game might reopen the razor clam fisheries in Ninilchik and Clam Gulch on the Kenai Peninsula for the first time since 2014. But before that can happen, biologists are hitting the beaches to count clams. KDLL's Sabine Pooks tagged along during one of the clam surveys in Ninilchik and has this report.
Technicians surveying the Ninilchik beach Wednesday are using some unlikely tools to stir up the clams hiding underneath the sand. Some are holding lacrosse sticks. Assistant Area Manager Holly Dixon is using a high-pressure water pump connected to a fire hose to liquefy the sand within a small circle of the beach.
And yeah, once the sand is liquefied inside the plot, razor clams will just sort of float to the surface. And so then people come in with these scoops and just sort of filter through the water and sand.
When they're sure there's no clams in a given plot, they pick up and run to the next spot, chasing the tide as it quickly pushes out. They haven't seen any clams on this part of the beach yet. Dixon says the circular plot they're probing is just one of hundreds they'll survey this week.
Right, we're still in about 200 feet from, you know, the start of the beach or the gravel line. So we'll start to get more into the best clam habitat once we get more like 300 to 500 feet out. So the middle of the beach has the most clams is what we typically see.
Fish and Game will use the clam counts to decide if there are enough to reopen sport and personal use clamming in Ninilchik and Clam Gulch for the first time since 2014. The closures have been a response to low razor clam counts on the east side of the inlet. The clam population crashed about a decade ago and has been slow to bounce back. In the meantime, clammers and sport fish charters have been taking their shovels over to the west side of the inlet, where the population is healthier. Fish and Game Area Manager Mike Booz says his department has been watching the clams closely.
Really at the close of the fishery, 16, 17, 18, we saw really large numbers of juvenile clams. And so that's kind of the first step in for numbers to rebuild, right? You get new clams showing up on the beach. So that was kind of the bright spot. The downside was during those years, we had really poor growth rates.
Today, he believes there might finally be enough clams to justify reopening some beaches. The Alaska Board of Fisheries just approved a management plan that sets a threshold for restarting a limited fishery with a bag limit of 30 clams per day.
This fishery is loved by so many Alaskans, and so you know, we're definitely like to hear from people and want everybody to understand, you know, really what's going on with these Cook Inlet razor clams.
Before the closure, the beaches on the east side were a mecca for clammers. Brent Johnson's been clamming since his family homesteaded on the Kenai Peninsula in the 1950s. They dig near their set net site on the beach in Clam Gulch, named for its abundance of clams.
I would describe it as great clamming. I mean, a person who went out in that area, we would get a bucket of clams. The limit was 60. We could get that on any minus one or two tide, something like that.
For several years in the 1980s and 90s, the sport fish harvest of clams was over a million. Clamming there was popular long before it became a regulated fishery. Johnson, who's also a historian, knows the first Alaska Native settlers of the land clammed as well. He's found shells buried on his parents' homestead. And he's seen surveys from the early 1900s that list Clam Gulch as a town name.
And so Clam Gulch must stretch back at least to 1920. So it was known for clamming at least back as far as 1920, I would say.
Johnson and his family clammed up until the closure in 2015. He'd cook the clams the same way his mom did when he was a kid.
We either fry them or we have clam chowder.
He's not sure he'll go clamming himself this summer if the fishery does reopen. He's vegan now, so he doesn't eat shellfish anymore. But Booz knows there are lots of people waiting, shovel-ready, to dig into the east side beaches again. Back in Ninilchik, technicians are several plots into their survey when eventually a small yellow shell bubbles to the surface. Booz takes out a ruler and points to the distinctly colored rings. It's like aging an oak tree.
So this is a three-year-old clam that didn't quite grow enough to make it to the adult size this year.
On its own, the clam doesn't look great. like many booze has seen, this one didn't make it to full maturity. And on the whole, he says it's not looking too good for Nanilchik. But he's more optimistic for the beaches at Clam Gulch, where he thinks there will be enough mature clams to have a fishery. He says his department will make a decision about the openers by the middle of next month. In Nanilchik, I'm Sabine Pooks.
A slumping section of the road into Denali National Park dropped an unexpected amount over the winter. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the latest activity underscores the need for a planned bridge over the unstable area about halfway out the 92-mile park road.
The landslide is the result of climate change accelerated movement of what's known as a rock glacier, which underlies a 100-yard stretch of the gravel road in an area of polychrome pass known as Pretty Rocks. Denali National Park Acting Superintendent Brooke Merrill says crews clearing snow from the road earlier this month found significant new slumping at the site.
It was really sobering to arrive on scene and see that 40-foot cliff on that eastern side of the slump this year.
Merrill says the drop is in line with the slide's multi-year progression.
It's just over twice as far as it slumped the year before, which is consistent. We've been watching it since about 2016, and each winter it sloughs about twice as far as the year before.
Park crews had filled the slump with gravel for years to keep the road drivable, but last August, acceleration of the slide forced closure of the road and serious consideration of a permanent fix. The NPS conducted an environmental review of a proposal to span the slide area with a 400-foot bridge anchored on solid ground on either side. The bridge plan was approved last month, and there is $25 million in the federal infrastructure law to pay for the first part of the estimated two-year project, which also includes some other Polychrome Pass area road work.
Our partners at Federal Highways are getting ready to issue a request for proposals for contractors to submit their design-build proposal for this bridge.
Merrill says the timing should allow earthwork and site preparation to get underway this summer. Additional funds will be needed to construct the bridge itself, but how much depends on the selected contractor's design. Until the bridge is completed, Merrill says park buses will only be traveling to the East Fork River at mile 43.
We've been working on making a safe spot for both transit and tour buses to turn around at this site.
Merrill says the only visitor access beyond mile 43 will be by air.
You can fly to Kantishna. We've got several of our in-holder lodges are operating as fly-in operations this year.
Merrill says the Park Service will not be operating its Wonder Lake campground near the end of the park road, but visitors can still apply for backcountry permits. She notes that Denali visitation is forecast to rebound to pre-pandemic levels this summer.
Indicators are that we'll likely be as busy as we were in 2019, which was a record-setting year for us.
Denali had over 600,000 visitors in 2019. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
An expert on marine geology and a leading researcher on the Queen Charlotte Fault believes the recent earthquake swarm under Mount Edgecombe near Sitka is consistent with volcanic activity. Dr. Gary Green is not suggesting an eruption is imminent, if one occurs at all, but he does think signs are pointing toward the upward movement of magma below Mount Edgecombe, which has been dormant for centuries. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Queen Charlotte Fault runs offshore southeast Alaska almost perfectly straight for over 500 miles. It's a rare geological feature called a leaky transform fault, where the North American and Pacific plates continually slip past each other. Because it's a plate boundary, the Queen Charlotte Fault is deep, extending down through the Earth's crust and into the mantle. Thousands of years ago, the movement of the fault opened a conduit in the crust, and molten magma pushed through and formed the Mount Edgecombe volcano. Dr. Gary Green thinks that the April 11th earthquake swarm indicates that the process may be underway again.
When magma starts heading towards the surface, it remelts the rock that is there, and it fractures that rock, and the fracturing is what causes the earthquake. So as the magma starts to move up into the crust and get closer to the surface, you start getting these low magnitude earthquakes. And then it can shut off, which it sounds like it has now, but it can start again. anytime.
Green is retired from a long career with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's an emeritus professor at the Moss Landing Marine Lab at San Jose State University, and he holds a research faculty position with the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Lab. But his specialty of late has been mapping the undersea Queen Charlotte Fault, and the Mount Edgecombe volcano is a product of that fault. The Queen Charlotte is tectonically active and reliably produces measurable earthquakes, which usually propagate laterally along the fault. The April 11th swarm was located under the mountain, and the quakes appeared to migrate upward from deep in the crust to shallower depths. But like his peers at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, Green says it's too early for dire predictions.
I mean, the good sign is that this might just be a hiccup. It just started, and there wasn't much pressure below and much dilation to cause this thing to really start to break towards the surface in an explosive event. But it also could be a precursor to what may occur sometime in the future.
Most Sitkins by now are probably envisioning Mount Edgecombe blowing its top and clouds of ash billowing into the sky like the famous eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. Again, Green says the structure of the Queen Charlotte Fault probably wouldn't lead to anything that dramatic. He pictures something a bit more tame.
This volcano is not like the volcanoes that sit down off of Seattle, for instance, and it's not like a St. Helens volcano. So these types of volcanoes generally have a small amount of explosive activity at the beginning of the of an eruption. A lot of ash will come out, but generally after a while it dies down, and they're more similar to a Hawaiian type of volcano.
One of the most active volcanoes in Hawaii isn't on the Big Island itself, but just offshore. Green says this could be a possibility for Mount Edgecombe, which isn't a lone volcanic peak, but one crater of many in a large volcanic field along the Southwest Rift, which links Kruzoff Island, where Mount Edgecombe is located, to the Queen Charlotte Fault 12 kilometers away, under the seafloor. An eruption somewhere along the rift is as much a possibility as an eruption on Mount Edgecombe. No one knows for sure right now. Although he's mainly a student of the fault, Green is glad the USGS is taking an active interest in what's happening in Mount Edgecombe. If I were really studying the volcano in any detail, he says, I'd want to get some instruments out there. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Insight Daily Radio. Country music icon Trace Adkins is back for a third season of INSP's cowboy competition series, Ultimate Cowboy Showdown. In Ultimate Cowboy Showdown, top cowboys from across the United States compete to win a herd of cattle worth at least $50,000, a coveted belt buckle, and a lifetime of bragging rights. Each week, viewers will watch them lock horns in a series of grueling individual and team challenges. They are judged on their skills, knowledge, grit, and passion. Chock full of explosive drama and lots of ego, the pressure is on for the cowboys to prove they have what it takes. We spoke to Trace about this exciting series.
I think the cowboy way is important because there's still some people out there that exemplify just good old-fashioned hard work. It's hard work. And, you know, they could be doing something else. I mean, in this world today, you know, with all the opportunities that people have in other fields, technology or whatever, I mean, these young folks, they could be doing something else. But there's something that draws them to this, and they love it, and it's in their soul, and they are not afraid of hard work, and they're not afraid of getting hurt.
That's country music icon Trace Adkins, letting viewers know what they can expect in the third season of INSP's cowboy competition series, Ultimate Cowboy Showdown, which premieres Thursday, April 21st at 8 p.m. Eastern on INSP. There's more at www.ultimatecowboyshowdowntv.com. Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Well, good afternoon. It's time for the Island Messenger. Today is Friday the 22nd in this year of 2022. It's also the month of April. The sun rose today at 6:40. It will set tonight at 9:37, and it will rise again tomorrow at 6:37. That's a total of 14 hours, 57 minutes of daylight. A gain of 4 minutes, 49 seconds. Record high, 56 degrees in 1936. Record low, 22 degrees in 1972. For Kodiak District tides, a high tide at 6:18 a.m. of 8.9 feet, a low tide at 1:28 p.m. of minus 0.2 feet, a high tide at 8:21 p.m. of 5.9 feet, and a low tide at 1:09 a.m. of 3.6 feet. For West Side tides, a Larsen Bay, a high tide at 6:45 a.m. of 13.3 feet, a low tide at 1:49 p.m. of 0 feet, a high tide at 8:29 p.m. of 10.2 feet, and a low tide at 1:53 a.m. of 5.7 feet, and a high tide at 7:53 a.m. of 12 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the April 22nd edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. What an interesting weather week again. I've lived here for over 30 years, and I don't remember another spring where hail was so prevalent. Although the hailstones here have been small compared to some of the doozies we used to get in the Midwest, it has added a nice new touch to Kodiak's squally spring weather. Along with the squally weather comes gusty winds, and the eagles were out having some serious fun in that wind on Thursday. Eagles normally like to catch thermals and circle higher and higher in the sky. On Thursday, though, I watched a bunch of them catching the wind gusts blasting up the cliff faces along Spruce Cape Road. They looked like they were playing tag, diving around toward each other, then catching a gust and poof, speeding away. Later in the day, I saw another eagle perform an acrobatic mid-flight flip, upside down, and then right back up to an upright position, much like a raven would. He was the only one around, so he wasn't showing off for any eagle friends that I could tell. And you know, when you see antics like that, you have to believe they're out there just having fun. Slowly but surely, other signs of spring are showing up. I saw my first shooting star plant with some tiny pink buds ready to open along a cliff face the other day. Fireweed shoots are showing up in their red and green glory too. This weekend is the Spring Women's Show at the Kodiak Harbor Convention Center downtown. Whether you're looking for information about just about everything from healthcare to gun safety, or you just want to treat yourself to a little something, you are bound to find something among the businesses represented there. The show opens Friday from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4. Have fun, and that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.